This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, August 6, 2010. In New York, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up on today's newscast, the Obama administration moves to enforce labor rights in Guatemala.
It took quite a long time, but it sends a good signal that this administration will pursue these cases.
But some fault the government for pushing free trade at the same time.
It's coming in the context of a renewed push to pass the new agreements that are before Congress.
The Senate approves more funding for security along the U.S.-Mexico border, which means more troops and an increase in unmanned drones in U.S. airspace.
Are they going to be invading people's privacy? There's a lot of questions that people have that really haven't been discussed.
And we'll go to a park in Mexico where visitors can experience what it's like to cross the border.
We gotta run, we gotta run.
Those stories and more coming up after this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Record high temperatures and drought have fueled scores of forest and peat fires across Russia this week. At least 30 people are reported dead, and the fires are having a major impact on human health and the environment. FSRN's Jenny Johnson reports from Russia.
Hundreds of fires are raging in the Moscow region, creating a thick, toxic mix in the air that is choking residents. Officials say 50 wildfires start in the region each day, and about one-third of those are peat fires. These fires burn from several feet underground and smolder even through winter. Environmentalists are criticizing the government for not taking the preventative measure of flooding at-risk areas prior to fire season. Government officials are blaming the financial crisis for cuts to firefighting budgets. Efforts to extinguish the fires have not been successful. The peat fires are of global significance as well because they contain vast stores of carbon that have accumulated over 1,000 years. Analysts liken the amount of carbon stored in Russia's peatlands to the amount of carbon stored in the Amazon rainforest. In addition, recent studies have confirmed that smoke from the fires is a direct contributor to the melting of the Arctic. Black carbon moves north where it lands on ice and snow, allowing for the increased absorption of heat. Jenny Johnson, FSRN, Russia.
The Supreme Court of Mexico has upheld a Mexico City law allowing same-sex marriage. The country's conservative ruling party brought the challenge to the ordinance. Mexico City began offering same-sex marriages last December. On Monday, the court will rule on a challenge to the law allowing gay couples to adopt. South Africa recalled its ambassador to Rwanda today amid concerns over the political climate of the Central African country. In June, gunmen attempted to assassinate an exiled Rwandan general in Johannesburg. This is just one in a string of instances of violence, oppression of opposition voices, and the press leading into Monday's national election. FSRN's Zach Badorf has more from Kigali, Rwanda.
The attack on the general was part of what Amnesty International calls a climate of repression in Rwanda in the run-up to presidential elections next week. The government has banned most opposition parties from participating, and consequently the ruling party's candidate and current president, Paul Kagame, is expected to win by a broad margin. In the past month, Rwanda's Media High Council suspended more than 24 newspapers. The country's foreign minister said in London today that Rwanda will not be held hostage by, quote, hate media. In addition, a Rwandan journalist who attempted to report on the assassination attempt in South Africa was recently murdered. The vice president of an opposition party was also beheaded. More than 5 million Rwandans, half the country's population, are registered to vote. Zach Badorf, FSRN, Kigali.
Former U.S. military personnel and civilians are suing Texas contractor Kellogg Brown & Root, saying their cancer and respiratory problems can be traced back to the company's open-air burning of trash on U.S. bases. According to the Washington Post, the contractor, commonly known as KBR, burned plastic, biological waste, paint, and other items in large open-air pits at bases in both Afghanistan and Iraq. The case, which was brought by nearly 250 people allegedly affected by the burning, faces an uphill battle and the difficult challenge of establishing causality for their illnesses. 65 years ago today, the U.S. dropped an atomic bomb on the western Japanese city of Hiroshima, killing 140,000 people. The annual ceremony marking the event was held earlier today, where approximately 55,000 people attended. As FSRN's Shuhei Nakayama reports, among them was an official representative of the U.S., the first to ever attend the ceremony.
That's the sound of the Hiroshima Bell of Peace, which is tolled ever August 6th at 8:15 a.m., marking the moment when the atomic bomb fell onto the city. For the first time, a U.S. ambassador commemorated the bombing with the representatives from 74 other countries. President Obama has stated a goal of working towards a world free of nuclear weapons. The mayor of Hiroshima, Tadatoshi Akiba, said at the ceremony he wanted the same thing.
The elimination of nuclear armaments is becoming urgent in the world. The voice of citizens can change international society. We need to give the voice to the world.
Audio courtesy of NHK. Japan has invited the U.S. to attend the commemoration each year, but the U.S. had previously declined. Delegates from the U.K. and France also attended this year's ceremony for the first time. More than 200,000 died in August 1945 between the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Japan surrendered days later, effectively ending World War II. Shuhei Nakayama, FSRN.
And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
This is Dorian Marina in New York. The Federal Communications Commission has called off closed-door talks with telecommunications industry giants over how the internet should be regulated. The announcement comes after Google and Verizon issued denials of media reports this week that the companies had negotiated a deal that would enable them to charge different rates for content carried over wireless broadband services. A tiered system of internet quality and speed goes against the principles of net neutrality, a concept that says internet service providers must treat all content as equal and deliver standardized service to customers. Senator Al Franken warned of pending merger deals and the need for more public say in internet regulation at last month's Netroots Nation conference.
The government has a role to play here. The government can pass rules to protect net neutrality. The government can stop mergers like NBC, Comcast, or at least put strict, rigorous conditions on them. But first, the government has to be made to act.
Thursday's news of a rumored deal reported in the New York Times and the Washington Post has provoked a swift response among net neutrality advocates. Andrew Schwartzman is the senior vice president for Media Access Project. That's a public interest law firm and advocacy group based in Washington, D.C. And he joins us to discuss the topic. Welcome to FSRN.
Hi there.
Let's start off by just giving us some insight here. What is the stir around these meetings this week between Verizon and Google? What is at stake?
Well, the FCC has been looking at whether it should take steps to restore its power with respect to broadband services so that it can adopt network neutrality regulations. In connection with that, it was holding a series of meetings with the large carriers, AT&T, Verizon, Comcast, and some of the other affected parties to the dispute, but members of the public had been left out of it.
Well, you said the FCC to restore their authority. What happened with their authority, and where does it stand right now?
In April, there was a decision from the Court of Appeals here in Washington that called into question the FCC's authority with respect to broadband. In particular, it would affect whether the FCC could impose network neutrality requirements.
And coming from these deals, how would the outcome affect this idea of net neutrality?
Well, the FCC has been proceeding on two tracks. One track is the public track, where they've been accepting public comments and accepting communications from members of the public and from affected companies with respect to it. But then they were having this separate set of private negotiations. It could mean that you would not be able to access everything on the internet because some of it would be blocked or slowed down or degraded, and that other content might be given to you on an extra special fast priority basis, but that service might be available only to some but not others.
Andrew Schwartzman is the Senior Vice President from Media Access Project, a public interest law firm based in Washington, D.C. The Obama administration has moved to enforce labor rights in Guatemala through the Central American Free Trade Agreement. Labor advocates cheer the effort but say the concept of protecting labor through free trade is a contradiction in terms. Meanwhile, they're giving the administration the thumbs down for using taxpayer funds to train workers in other countries to take outsourced American jobs. Tanya Snyder reports.
Labor activists in the U.S. and Central America fought the ratification of the Central America Free Trade Agreement, or CAFTA. They said it promoted a race to the bottom, with poor countries outbidding each other to offer global corporations the lowest wages and worst working conditions. Guatemala has taken that race to the bottom to a new low, with documented murders of trade unionists and the firing of workers involved with labor organizing. The AFL-CIO and Guatemalan labor groups complained more than 2 years ago about labor violations. The U.S. government investigated and announced recently that it's filing a complaint, the first such case the U.S. has pursued against a free trade partner.
It took quite a long time, but it sends a good signal that this administration will pursue these cases.
Jeff Vogt is a global economic policy specialist at the AFL-CIO.
The conditions in Guatemala, I think, have substantially worsened. I mean, the labor rights enforcement has never been good, and it hasn't gotten any better. Anti-union violence in Guatemala has also increased substantially since CAFTA was ratified.
But some say a complaint against labor violations in the context of a free trade agreement is almost a contradiction in terms. Laura Carlson directs the Americas program at the Center for International Policy.
The government of Guatemala is being punished for not enforcing labor rights in an economic context in which, in order to survive and compete in attracting foreign investment, it really can't enforce labor rights.
She says Guatemala, by entering into a free trade deal with the U.S., adopted a model that depends on foreign investment for economic growth, a model which already didn't work in the case of NAFTA.
But when you're committed to entice foreign investment, one of the things that the government has to provide is low-cost labor.
She also thinks there's something kind of fishy about the timing.
It's thought that it's coming in the context of a renewed push to pass the new agreements that are before Congress. These include the Colombia Agreement, the Panama Agreement, and the South Korea Agreement.
The Colombia Agreement has been especially controversial, and Obama himself spoke against it on the campaign trail because violent repression of labor unions is rampant in Colombia. Activists question why Guatemala is getting singled out for its violations while the U.S. pursues expanded trade relations with a country with an even worse record. And that's not the only thing that's got labor activists scratching their heads right now. Information Week is reporting that USAID is funding job training for workers in other countries so that they can take outsourced American jobs. Rob Scott of the Economic Policy Institute says yes, people in Sri Lanka and Armenia have a right to good jobs, but that should come through enforcement of the right to organize and through development assistance that increases people's buying power.
I think the last thing that we need to do is train them to take over our jobs and loan them money to take over our industries. That is non-productive aid. It's counterproductive.
USAID is contributing $10 million to a $36 million project in Sri Lanka to teach people business skills, tech skills, and the English language. An undisclosed amount is also going to Armenia, which is actively trying to market itself globally as a low-cost destination for outsourced IT and engineering jobs from richer countries. Tanya Snyder, FSRN.
The free trade agreements of NAFTA and CAFTA have also been blamed for increasing the rate of economic migration from Mexico and Central America to the United States. An estimated 12 million undocumented immigrants live in the U.S. Many have arrived via a clandestine border crossing. The actual feat of crossing the border requires steady nerves and physical exertion. Many first-time crossers are not fully aware of what to expect, but would-be migrants and the curious can get a taste of what it's like at an ecotourism park in central Mexico. Shannon Young has more.
Visitors begin to congregate in a parking lot in El Alberto after sundown, chatting amongst themselves in small groups. At about 9 p.m., Ernesto Oliva stands on the flatbed of a pickup truck and calls out the names of the people who have signed up for a five-hour walk.
Cesar Romero! Miriam Cruz!
Groups of 10 jump into the beds of waiting pickup trucks, which take us to a drop-off point by the side of the town's church. That's where we meet our guide for the night, a man wearing a ski mask who never identifies himself by name. He's going to get us across the border. Not the real U.S.-Mexico border, but a fake one, part of a theme park in El Alberto, a small indigenous Ñañu village in the Mexican state of Hidalgo.
What we do is put on a show about what it's like to cross the border. That way, people who don't plan on going there, the U.S., learn what it's like. And those who do want to go, learn that it's not easy.
The official population of El Alberto is around 2,200 people. Townspeople say at least 70% of the population lives in the United States. But those who have left must return to put in 1 year's stints of mandatory community service in order to retain their moral and land rights within the community. That's the case with Ernesto Oliva, who left El Alberto as a 14-year-old to search for work.
You're told 1 year in advance when it's your turn for community service so you can get your money together and make plans to return. Here in the town, we don't earn a single cent for our work. Everyone there in the U.S. knows when it's their turn to put in work here, so they come to perform their social service. After the year is up, they have to find another job. Many go back to the U.S., others don't, and some stay here.
Mandatory community service is a custom in traditional indigenous villages throughout Mexico. Oliva's service includes playing a border patrol agent in the nighttime border crossing simulation. Oliva, who has crossed the border for real 4 times, says the simulation is fairly accurate, only less risky than the real thing.
Bienvenidos todo. ¿De qué parte vienen?
The guide begins by welcoming us and asking us where we're from before putting the night walk into context.
Para nosotros no es algo decir ser emigrante ser un chingón, no.
We're not saying that to be a migrant is to be a hotshot. Quite the opposite. Why? Because a migrant suffers, leaving behind country, family, roots, and all those things.
Su país, dejando su familia, dejando muchas cosas atrás, sus raíces y todo.
The opening discussion includes lighthearted jokes, serious reminders about the dangers real migrants face, insights into the local indigenous Ñañu culture, and a lecture about teamwork. It ends with the group intonation of Mexico's national anthem.
Mexicanos al grito de guerra.
Within minutes, we're running down a hillside in the total darkness.
So we're getting instructions from the guide, and we're all crouched down on the side of the road. He's telling us to. We gotta run. Hiding in the ravine now, it's by a river. Oh man.
After hiding for a long time in the river brush, having other close encounters with the border patrol, creeping through a pitch black tunnel and hiking up a steep canyon slope, our guide congratulates us, saying the walk is nearly over. He tells us that while many of us have probably never walked in a similar situation before, that we've done a good job. In fact, the only people who were caught were actors from the town. The exhausting walk ends around 2 a.m. University student Jose Antonio Rubio participated in the walk with a couple of his friends. He says his father migrated to the U.S. 10 years ago and would like to encourage Americans to come on the walk to see how difficult crossing the border is. Shannon Young, FSRN, El Alberto, Mexico.
U.S.-Mexico border crossers can also soon encounter unmanned aerial drones and newly deployed National Guard troops. Yesterday, just before the summer recess, the Senate approved an additional $600 million in funding for border security. The bill is introduced by Democratic Senators Chuck Schumer of New York and Claire McCaskill of Missouri. They say it will add 10% to spending on border security over the 2010 level, along with an increase in Border Patrol agents and establishing four forward operating bases along the border. The measure puts aside $32 million for drone aircrafts to gather surveillance images and search for illegal activity. For a look at the increase in drones along the border, we're joined by Melissa Del Bosque. She's an investigative reporter with the Texas Observer magazine and writes the regular blog La Linea. Welcome to FSRN.
Thank you for having me.
U.S. Customs and Border Protection have been using drones along that border region since 2005. Now, this would mark an increase in their use. The ones that are being used today, what kind of drones are they and how are they being used?
The drones are using the Predator B. What they do is provide real-time video footage, and they can also do infrared. And what they use them for is to look for smuggling routes along the border, and then what they do is they have an analyst that interprets the data that's sent from the drone, and then they contact Border Patrol to alert them if they see people coming across the border illegally.
One of the criticisms of the drone program abroad is that it's operated by people who are thousands of miles away, and so there's a kind of a breakdown in a chain of command, a breakdown in accountability. Is it clear at this point who would be controlling these drones and who would be controlling this information?
Well, Customs and Border Protection is training its own pilots. When they first started the program in 2005, they were using private contractors that worked for General Atomics, which is the company that makes the drone. But they had a crash in 2006. A drone crashed into the side of a hill outside of Nogales, Arizona. And in hearing the testimony of Customs and Border Protection, they faulted the private contractor, and they say one of the things they're doing to improve their safety record is by training their own pilots to remotely operate the drones.
There have been other major and also costly security projects along the border since the 1990s. There was Operation Gatekeeper, Operation Hold the Line. There was that virtual fence that had major problems, and that was also led by Boeing. Boeing also makes a type of unmanned drone. Who stands to profit from this kind of program? Who are making these drones?
All the large defense contractors are making these drones. General Atomics makes the Predator B, which U.S. Customs and Border Protection is using. And as you said, Boeing Corporation had been the contractor for SBINet, which was an $8 billion project. And it was scrapped, I think, after they spent about $1 billion on it and figured out that it wasn't working. Basically, the usual large contractor companies that get a lot of Department of Defense contracts.
Now, a frequent complaint from border residents is that these Washington policies don't take into consideration the realities of border communities. As a border reporter there, what have you seen as an effective course of action, an appropriate course of action for policymakers?
I'm hearing from people that they just don't really understand the program. They're concerned about the safety data. They don't know what kind of information they're going to be providing to the government. Are they going to be invading people's privacy? There's a lot of questions that people have that really haven't been discussed by the federal government with the local communities.
So a lot of questions still to be answered. $32 million set aside in this Senate bill yesterday for more drones along the border region. Melissa Del Bosque is an investigative reporter with the Texas Observer. She writes a regular blog, La Linea, and she spoke to us about the push for more drones along the U.S.-Mexico border. Thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
California schools are facing massive budget cuts from the state. The weak economy is forcing some school districts to look at creative ways to bring in revenue and keep classes going. In Northern California's Mendocino County, one school district has turned to farming to raise funds and feed the community. From Ukiah, Christina Anastad has more.
It's 8:30 in the morning, and the Ukiah High School's ag department is bustling with students.
Okay. Who's in compost and soil building?
You guys turn around, please.
Nobody.
Giovanni's one of them.
These students are getting ready for a lesson in agriculture. They'll spend half their time in the classroom and the other half outdoors, working the school's 1.5-acre farm. Julie Drucker helps manage the program.
We're going through a full cycle of food production. So the kids are planting food, doing bed formation, learning how to make compost.
After harvest, the students will open their own farm stand on campus, and through a kind of co-op arrangement called community-supported agriculture, they'll sell the produce to teachers, families, and the greater community. The project is called the Hillside Farm, and it's funded with federal stimulus money. For 16-year-old DNA Garcia, the class has changed the way she views food.
I didn't really care what was in it or anything. As long as it was food, I just ate it. It's like now that I have a connection with agriculture, it's like, wow, we grew this and we're eating it and it's really good.
Students aren't just growing vegetables, they're also learning how to produce fish with a new sustainable fish farm on campus. A few yards away, a group of community volunteers is preparing the ground to lay concrete for the fish enclosure necessary for seafood like prawns and tilapia.
The fish are farmed at the bottom and the vegetables are farmed at the top.
Max Myers is an aquaponics expert spearheading the project.
The fish water is pumped out to the vegetables. The vegetables feed off the nutrient source in the water, thereby cleaning the water, and then the clean water returns.
This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, August. This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, August 6, 2010. In New York, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up on today's newscast, the Obama administration moves to enforce labor rights in Guatemala.
It took quite a long time, but it sends a good signal that this administration will pursue these cases.
But some fault the government for pushing free trade at the same time.
It's coming in the context of a renewed push to pass the new agreements that are before Congress.
The Senate approves more funding for security along the U.S.-Mexico border, which means more troops and an increase in unmanned drones in U.S. airspace.
Are they going to be invading people's privacy? There's a lot of questions that people have that really haven't been discussed.
And we'll go to a park in Mexico where visitors can experience what it's like to cross the border.
We gotta run.
Those stories and more coming up after this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Record high temperatures and drought have fueled scores of forest and peat fires across Russia this week. At least 30 people are reported dead, and the fires are having a major impact on human health and the environment. FSRN's Jenny Johnson reports from Russia.
Hundreds of fires are raging in the Moscow region, creating a thick, toxic mix in the air that is choking residents. Officials say 50 wildfires start in the region each day, and about one-third of those are peat fires. These fires burn from several feet underground and smolder even through winter. Environmentalists are criticizing the government for not taking the preventative measure of flooding at-risk areas prior to fire season. Government officials are blaming the financial crisis for cuts to firefighting budgets. Efforts to extinguish the fires have not been successful. The peat fires are of global significance as well because they contain vast stores of carbon that have accumulated over 1,000 years. Analysts liken the amount of carbon stored in Russia's peatlands to the amount of carbon stored in the Amazon rainforest. In addition, recent studies have confirmed that smoke from the fires is a direct contributor to the melting of the Arctic. Black carbon moves north where it lands on ice and snow, allowing for the increased absorption of heat. Jenny Johnson, FSRN, Russia.
The Supreme Court of Mexico has upheld a Mexico City law allowing same-sex marriage. The country's conservative ruling party brought the challenge to the ordinance. Mexico City began offering same-sex marriages last December. On Monday, the court will rule on a challenge to the law allowing gay couples to adopt. South Africa recalled its ambassador to Rwanda today amid concerns over the political climate of the Central African country. In June, gunmen attempted to assassinate an exiled Rwandan general in Johannesburg. This is just one in a string of instances of violence, oppression of opposition voices, and the press leading into Monday's national election. FSRN's Zach Badorf has more from Kigali, Rwanda.
The attack on the general was part of what Amnesty International calls a climate of repression in Rwanda in the run-up to presidential elections next week. The government has banned most opposition parties from participating, and consequently the ruling party's candidate and current president, Paul Kagame, is expected to win by a broad margin. In the past month, Rwanda's Media High Council suspended more than two dozen newspapers. The country's foreign minister said in London today that Rwanda will not be held hostage by, quote, hate media. In addition, a Rwandan journalist who attempted to report on the assassination attempt in South Africa was recently murdered. The vice president of an opposition party was also beheaded. More than 5 million Rwandans, half the country's population, are registered to vote. Zach Badorf, FSRN, Kigali.
Former U.S. military personnel and civilians are suing Texas contractor Kellogg Brown & Root, saying their cancer and respiratory problems can be traced back to the company's open-air burning of trash on U.S. bases. According to the Washington Post, the contractor, commonly known as KBR, burned plastic, biological waste, paint, and other items in large open-air pits at bases in both Afghanistan and Iraq. The case, which was brought by nearly 250 people allegedly affected by the burning, faces an uphill battle and the difficult challenge of establishing causality for their illnesses. 65 years ago today, the U.S. dropped an atomic bomb on the western Japanese city of Hiroshima, killing 140,000 people. The annual ceremony marking the event was held earlier today, where approximately 55,000 people attended. As FSRN's Shuhei Nakayama reports, among them was an official representative of the U.S., the first to ever attend the ceremony.
That's the sound of the Hiroshima Bell of Peace, which is tolled ever August 6th at 8:15 a.m., marking the moment when the atomic bomb fell onto the city. For the first time, a U.S. ambassador commemorated the bombing with the representatives from 74 other countries. President Obama has stated a goal of working towards a world free of nuclear weapons. The mayor of Hiroshima, Tadatoshi Akiba, said at the ceremony he wanted the same thing.
The elimination of nuclear armaments is becoming urgent in the world. The voice of citizens can change international society. We need to give the voice to the world.
Audio courtesy of NHK. Japan has invited the U.S. to attend the commemoration each year, but the U.S. had previously declined. Delegates from the U.K. and France also attended this year's ceremony for the first time. More than 200,000 died in August 1945 between the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Japan surrendered days later, effectively ending World War II. Shuhei Nakayama, FSRN.
And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
This is Dorian Marina in New York. The Federal Communications Commission has called off closed-door talks with telecommunications industry giants over how the internet should be regulated. The announcement comes after Google and Verizon issued denials of media reports this week that the companies had negotiated a deal that would enable them to charge different rates for content carried over wireless broadband services. A tiered system of internet quality and speed goes against the principles of net neutrality, a concept that says internet service providers must treat all content as equal and deliver standardized service to customers. Senator Al Franken warned of pending merger deals and the need for more public say in internet regulation at last month's Netroots Nation conference.
The government has a role to play here. The government can pass rules to protect net neutrality. The government can stop mergers like NBC, Comcast, or at least put strict, rigorous conditions on them. But first, the government has to be made to act.
Thursday's news of a rumored deal reported in the New York Times and the Washington Post has provoked a swift response among net neutrality advocates. Andrew Schwartzman is the senior vice president for Media Access Project. That's a public interest law firm and advocacy group based in Washington, D.C. And he joins us to discuss the topic. Welcome to FSRN.
Hi there.
Let's start off by just giving us some insight here. What is the stir around these meetings this week between Verizon and Google? What is at stake?
Well, the FCC has been looking at whether it should take steps to restore its power with respect to broadband services so that it can adopt network neutrality regulations. In connection with that, it was holding a series of meetings with the large carriers, AT&T, Verizon, Comcast, and some of the other affected parties to the dispute, but members of the public had been left out of it.
Well, you said the FCC to restore their authority. What happened with their authority, and where does it stand right now?
In April, there was a decision from the Court of Appeals here in Washington that called into question the FCC's authority with respect to broadband. In particular, it would affect whether the FCC could impose network neutrality requirements.
And coming from these deals, how would the outcome affect this idea of net neutrality?
Well, the FCC has been proceeding on two tracks. One track is the public track, where they've been accepting public comments and accepting communications from members of the public and from affected companies with respect to it. But then they were having the separate set of private negotiations. It could mean that you would not be able to access everything on the Internet because some of it would be blocked or slowed down or degraded, and that other content might be given to you on an extra special fast priority basis, but that service might be available only to some but not others.
Andrew Schwartzman is the senior vice president from Media Access Project, a public interest law firm based in Washington, D.C. The Obama administration has moved to enforce labor rights in Guatemala through the Central American Free Trade Agreement. Labor advocates cheer the effort but say the concept of protecting labor through free trade is a contradiction in terms. Meanwhile, they're giving the administration the thumbs down for using taxpayer funds to train workers in other countries to take outsourced American jobs. Tanya Snyder reports.
Labor activists in the U.S. and Central America fought the ratification of the Central America Free Trade Agreement, or CAFTA. They said it promoted a race to the bottom, with poor countries outbidding each other to offer global corporations the lowest wages and worst working conditions. Guatemala has taken that race to the bottom to a new low, with documented murders of trade unionists and the firing of workers involved with labor organizing. The AFL-CIO and Guatemalan labor groups complained more than 2 years ago about labor violations. The U.S. government investigated and announced recently that it's filing a complaint, the first such case the U.S. has pursued against a free trade partner.
It took quite a long time, but it sends a good signal that this administration will pursue these cases.
Jeff Vogt is a global economic policy specialist at the AFL-CIO.
The conditions in Guatemala, I think, have substantially worsened. I mean, the labor rights enforcement has never been good, and it hasn't gotten any better. Anti-union violence in Guatemala has also increased substantially since CAFTA was ratified.
But some say a complaint against labor violations in the context of a free trade agreement is almost a contradiction in terms. Laura Carlson directs the Americas program at the Center for International Policy.
The government of Guatemala is being punished for not enforcing labor rights in an economic context in which, in order to survive and compete in attracting foreign investment, it really can't enforce labor rights.
She says Guatemala, by entering into a free trade deal with the U.S., adopted a model that depends on foreign investment for economic growth, a model which already didn't work in the case of NAFTA.
But when you're committed to entice foreign investment, one of the things that the government has to provide is low-cost labor.
She also thinks there's something kind of fishy about the timing.
It's thought that it's coming in the context of a renewed push to pass the new agreements that are before Congress. These include the Colombia Agreement, the Panama Agreement, and the South Korea Agreement.
The Colombia Agreement has been especially controversial, and Obama himself spoke against it on the campaign trail because violent repression of labor unions is rampant in Colombia. Activists question why Guatemala is getting singled out for its violations while the U.S. pursues expanded trade relations with a country with an even worse record. And that's not the only thing that's got labor activists scratching their heads right now. Information Week is reporting that USAID is funding job training for workers in other countries so that they can take outsourced American jobs. Rob Scott of the Economic Policy Institute says yes, people in Sri Lanka and Armenia have a right to good jobs, but that should come through enforcement of the right to organize and through development assistance that increases people's buying power.
I think the last thing that we need to do is train them to take over our jobs and loan them money to take over our industries. That is non-productive aid. It's counterproductive.
USAID is contributing $10 million to a $36 million project in Sri Lanka to teach people business skills, tech skills, and the English language. An undisclosed amount is also going to Armenia, which is actively trying to market itself globally as a low-cost destination for outsourced IT and engineering jobs from richer countries. Tanya Snyder, FSRN.
The free trade agreements of NAFTA and CAFTA have also been blamed for increasing the rate of economic migration from Mexico and Central America to the United States. An estimated 12 million undocumented immigrants live in the U.S. Many have arrived via a clandestine border crossing. The actual feat of crossing the border requires steady nerves and physical exertion. Many first-time crossers are not fully aware of what to expect, but would-be migrants and the curious can get a taste of what it's like at an ecotourism park in central Mexico. Shannon Young has more.
Visitors begin to congregate in a parking lot in El Alberto after sundown, chatting amongst themselves in small groups. At about 9 p.m., Ernesto Oliva stands on the flatbed of a pickup truck and calls out the names of the people who have signed up for a five-hour walk.
Cesar Romero! Miriam Cruz!
Groups of 10 jump into the beds of waiting pickup trucks, which take us to a drop-off point by the side of the town's church. That's where we meet our guide for the night, a man wearing a ski mask who never identifies himself by name. He's going to get us across the border. Not the real U.S.-Mexico border, but a fake one, part of a theme park in El Alberto, a small indigenous Ñañu village in the Mexican state of Hidalgo.
What we do is put on a show about what it's like to cross the border. That way, people who don't plan on going there, the U.S., learn what it's like. And those who do want to go, learn that it's not easy.
This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, August 6, 2010. In New York, I'm Doreen Marina. Coming up on today's newscast, the Obama administration moves to enforce labor rights in Guatemala.
It took quite a long time, but it sends a good signal that this administration will pursue these cases.
But some fault the government for pushing free trade at the same time.
It's coming in the context of a renewed push to pass the new agreements that are before Congress.
The Senate approves more funding for security along the U.S.-Mexico border, which means more troops and an increase in unmanned drones in U.S. airspace.
Are they going to be invading people's privacy? There's a lot of questions that people have that really haven't been discussed.
And we'll go to a park in Mexico where visitors can experience what it's like to cross the border.
We gotta run.
Those stories and more coming up after this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Record high temperatures and drought have fueled scores of forest and peat fires across Russia this week. At least 30 people are reported dead, and the fires are having a major impact on human health and the environment. FSRN's Jenny Johnson reports from Russia.
Hundreds of fires are raging in the Moscow region, creating a thick, toxic mix in the air that is choking residents. Officials say 50 wildfires start in the region each day, and about one-third of those are peat fires. These fires burn from several feet underground and smolder even through winter. Environmentalists are criticizing the government for not taking the preventative measure of flooding at-risk areas prior to fire season. Government officials are blaming the financial crisis for cuts to firefighting budgets. Efforts to extinguish the fires have not been successful. The peat fires are of global significance as well because they contain vast stores of carbon that have accumulated over 1,000 years. Analysts liken the amount of carbon stored in Russia's peatlands to the amount of carbon stored in the Amazon rainforest. In addition, recent studies have confirmed that smoke from the fires is a direct contributor to the melting of the Arctic. Black carbon moves north where it lands on ice and snow, allowing for the increased absorption of heat. Jenny Johnson, FSRN, Russia.
The Supreme Court of Mexico has upheld a Mexico City law allowing same-sex marriage. The country's conservative ruling party brought the challenge to the ordinance. Mexico City began offering same-sex marriages last December. On Monday, the court will rule on a challenge to the law allowing gay couples to adopt. South Africa recalled its ambassador to Rwanda today amid concerns over the political climate of the Central African country. In June, gunmen attempted to assassinate an exiled Rwandan general in Johannesburg. This is just one in a string of instances of violence, oppression of opposition voices, and the press leading into Monday's national election. FSRN's Zach Badorf has more from Kigali, Rwanda.
The attack on the general was part of what Amnesty International calls a climate of repression in Rwanda in the run-up to presidential elections next week. The government has banned most opposition parties from participating, and consequently the ruling party's candidate and current president, Paul Kagame, is expected to win by a broad margin. In the past month, Rwanda's Media High Council suspended more than 24 newspapers. The country's foreign minister said in London today that Rwanda will not be held hostage by, quote, hate media. In addition, a Rwandan journalist who attempted to report on the assassination attempt in South Africa was recently murdered. The vice president of an opposition party was also beheaded. More than 5 million Rwandans, half the country's population, are registered to vote. Zach Badorf, FSRN, Kigali.
Former U.S. military personnel and civilians are suing Texas contractor Kellogg Brown & Root, saying their cancer and respiratory problems can be traced back to the company's open-air burning of trash on U.S. bases. According to the Washington Post, the contractor, commonly known as KBR, burned plastic, biological waste, paint, and other items in large open-air pits at bases in both Afghanistan and Iraq. The case, which was brought by nearly 250 people allegedly affected by the burning, faces an uphill battle and the difficult challenge of establishing causality for their illnesses. 65 years ago today, the U.S. dropped an atomic bomb on the western Japanese city of Hiroshima, killing 140,000 people. The annual ceremony marking the event was held earlier today, where approximately 55,000 people attended. As FSRN's Shuhei Nakayama reports, among them was an official representative of the U.S., the first to ever attend the ceremony.
That's the sound of the Hiroshima Bell of Peace, which is tolled every August 6th at 8:15 a.m., marking the moment when the atomic bomb fell onto the city. For the first time, a U.S. ambassador commemorated the bombing with the representatives from 74 other countries. President Obama has stated a goal of working towards a world free of nuclear weapons. The mayor of Hiroshima, Tadatoshi Akiba, said at the ceremony he wanted the same thing.
The elimination of nuclear armaments is becoming urgent in the world. The voice of citizens can change international society. We need to give the voice to the world.
Audio courtesy of NHK. Japan has invited the U.S. to attend the commemoration each year, but the U.S. had previously declined. Delegates from the U.K. and France also attended this year's ceremony for the first time. More than 200,000 died in August 1945 between the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Japan surrendered days later, effectively ending World War II. Shuhei Nakayama, FSRN.
And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
This is Dorian Marina in New York. The Federal Communications Commission has called off closed-door talks with telecommunications industry giants over how the internet should be regulated. The announcement comes after Google and Verizon issued denials of media reports this week that the companies had negotiated a deal that would enable them to charge different rates for content carried over wireless broadband services. A tiered system of internet quality and speed goes against the principles of net neutrality, a concept that says internet service providers must treat all content as equal and deliver standardized service to customers. Senator Al Franken warned of pending merger deals and the need for more public say in internet regulation at last month's Netroots Nation conference.
The government has a role to play here. The government can pass rules to protect net neutrality. The government can stop mergers like NBC, Comcast, or at least put strict, rigorous conditions on them. But first, the government has to be made to act.
Thursday's news of a rumored deal reported in the New York Times and the Washington Post has provoked a swift response among net neutrality advocates. Andrew Schwartzman is the senior vice president for Media Access Project. That's a public interest law firm and advocacy group based in Washington, D.C. And he joins us to discuss the topic. Welcome to FSRN.
Hi there.
Let's start off by just giving us some insight here. What is the stir around these meetings this week between Verizon and Google? What is at stake?
Well, the FCC has been looking at whether it should take steps to restore its power with respect to broadband services so that it can adopt network neutrality regulations. In connection with that, it was holding a series of meetings with the large carriers, AT&T, Verizon, Comcast, and some of the other affected parties to the dispute, but members of the public had been left out of it.
Well, you said the FCC to restore their authority. What happened with their authority, and where does it stand right now?
In April, there was a decision from the Court of Appeals here in Washington that called into question the FCC's authority with respect to broadband. In particular, it would affect whether the FCC could impose network neutrality requirements.
And coming from these deals, how would the outcome affect this idea of net neutrality?
Well, the FCC has been proceeding on two tracks. One track is the public track, where they've been accepting public comments and accepting communications from members of the public and from affected companies with respect to it. But then they were having this separate set of private negotiations. It could mean that you would not be able to access everything on the internet because some of it would be blocked or slowed down or degraded, and that other content might be given to you on an extra special fast priority basis, but that service might be available only to some but not others.
Andrew Schwartzman is the senior vice president from Media Access Project, a public interest law firm based in Washington, D.C. The Obama administration has moved to enforce labor rights in Guatemala through the Central American Free Trade Agreement. Labor advocates cheer the effort but say the concept of protecting labor through free trade is a contradiction in terms. Meanwhile, they're giving the administration the thumbs down for using taxpayer funds to train workers in other countries to take outsourced American jobs. Tanya Snyder reports.
Labor activists in the U.S. and Central America fought the ratification of the Central America Free Trade Agreement, or CAFTA. They said it promoted a race to the bottom, with poor countries outbidding each other to offer global corporations the lowest wages and worst working conditions. Guatemala has taken that race to the bottom to a new low, with documented murders of trade unionists and the firing of workers involved with labor organizing. The AFL-CIO and Guatemalan labor groups complained more than 2 years ago about labor violations. The U.S. government investigated and announced recently that it's filing a complaint, the first such case the U.S. has pursued against a free trade partner.
It took quite a long time, but it sends a good signal that this administration will pursue these cases.
Jeff Vogt is a global economic policy specialist at the AFL-CIO.
The conditions in Guatemala, I think, have substantially worsened. I mean, the labor rights enforcement has never been good, and it hasn't gotten any better. Anti-union violence in Guatemala has also increased substantially since CAFTA was ratified.
But some say a complaint against labor violations in the context of a free trade agreement is almost a contradiction in terms. Laura Carlson directs the Americas program at the Center for International Policy.
The government of Guatemala is being punished for not enforcing labor rights in an economic context in which, in order to survive and compete in attracting foreign investment, it really can't enforce labor rights.
She says Guatemala, by entering into a free trade deal with the U.S., adopted a model that depends on foreign investment for economic growth, a model which already didn't work in the case of NAFTA.
But when you're committed to entice foreign investment, one of the things that the government has to provide is low-cost labor.
She also thinks there's something kind of fishy about the timing.
It's thought that it's coming in the context of a renewed push to pass the new agreements that are before Congress. These include the Colombia Agreement, the Panama Agreement, and the South Korea Agreement.
The Colombia Agreement has been especially controversial, and Obama himself spoke against it on the campaign trail because violent repression of labor unions is rampant in Colombia. Activists question why Guatemala is getting singled out for its violations while the U.S. pursues expanded trade relations with a country with an even worse record. And that's not the only thing that's got labor activists scratching their heads right now. Information Week is reporting that USAID is funding job training for workers in other countries so that they can take outsourced American jobs. Rob Scott of the Economic Policy Institute says yes, people in Sri Lanka and Armenia have a right to good jobs, but that should come through enforcement of the right to organize and through development assistance that increases people's buying power.
I think the last thing that we need to do is train them to take over our jobs and loan them money to take over our industries. That is non-productive aid. It's counterproductive.
USAID is contributing $10 million to a $36 million project in Sri Lanka to teach people business skills, tech skills, and the English language. An undisclosed amount is also going to Armenia, which is actively trying to market itself globally as a low-cost destination for outsourced IT and engineering jobs from richer countries. Tanya Snyder, FSRN.
The free trade agreements of NAFTA and CAFTA have also been blamed for increasing the rate of economic migration from Mexico and Central America to the United States. An estimated 12 million undocumented immigrants live in the U.S. Many have arrived via a clandestine border crossing. The actual feat of crossing the border requires steady nerves and physical exertion. Many first-time crossers are not fully aware of what to expect, but would-be migrants and the curious can get a taste of what it's like at an ecotourism park in central Mexico. Shannon Young has more.
Visitors begin to congregate in a parking lot in El Alberto after sundown, chatting amongst themselves in small groups. At about 9 p.m., Ernesto Oliva stands on the flatbed of a pickup truck and calls out the names of the people who have signed up for a five-hour walk.
Cesar Romero! William Cruz!
Groups of 10 jump into the beds of waiting pickup trucks, which take us to a drop-off point by the side of the town's church. That's where we meet our guide for the night, a man wearing a ski mask who never identifies himself by name. He's going to get us across the border. Not the real U.S.-Mexico border, but a fake one, part of a theme park in El Alberto, a small indigenous Ñañu village in the Mexican state of Hidalgo.
What we do is put on a show about what it's like to cross the border. That way, people who don't plan on going there, the U.S., learn what it's like. And those who do want to go, learn that it's not easy.
The official population of El Alberto is around 2,200 people. Townspeople say at least 70% of the population lives in the United States. But those who have left must return to put in 1 year's stints of mandatory community service in order to retain their moral and land rights within the community. That's the case with Ernesto Oliva, who left El Alberto as a 14-year-old to search for work.
You're told 1 year in advance when it's your turn for community service so you can get your money together and make plans to return. Here in the town, we don't earn a single cent for our work. Everyone there in the U.S. knows when it's their turn to put in work here, so they come to perform their social service. After the year is up, they have to find another job. Many go back to the U.S., others don't, and some stay here.
Mandatory community service is a custom in traditional indigenous villages throughout Mexico. Oliva's service includes playing a border patrol agent in the nighttime border crossing simulation. Oliva, who has crossed the border for real 4 times, says the simulation is fairly accurate, only less risky than the real thing.
Bienvenidos todo. ¿De qué parte vienen?
The guide begins by welcoming us and asking us where we're from before putting the night walk into context.
Para nosotros no es algo decir ser emigrante, ser un chingón, no.
We're not saying that to be a migrant is to be a hotshot. Quite the opposite. Why? Because a migrant suffers, leaving behind country, family, roots, and all those things.
Su país, dejando su familia, dejando muchas cosas atrás, sus raíces y todo.
The opening discussion includes lighthearted jokes, serious reminders about the dangers real migrants face, insights into the local indigenous Ñañu culture, and a lecture about teamwork. It ends with the group intonation of Mexico's national anthem.
Mexicanos al grito de guerra.
Within minutes, we're running down a hillside in the total darkness.
So we're getting instructions from the guide, and we're all crouched down on the side of the road. He's telling us to. We gotta run. Hiding in the ravine now, it's by a river. Oh man.
After hiding for a long time in the river brush, having other close encounters with the border patrol, creeping through a pitch black tunnel, and hiking up a steep canyon slope, our guide congratulates us, saying the walk is nearly over. He tells us that while many of us have probably never walked in a similar situation before, that we've done a good job. In fact, the only people who were caught were actors from the town. The exhausting walk ends around 2 a.m. University student Jose Antonio Rubio participated in the walk with a couple of his friends. He says his father migrated to the U.S. 10 years ago and would like to encourage Americans to come on the walk to see how difficult crossing the border is. Shannon Young, FSRN, El Alberto, Mexico.
U.S.-Mexico border crossers can also soon encounter unmanned aerial drones and newly deployed National Guard troops. Yesterday, just before the summer recess, the Senate approved an additional $600 million in funding for border security. The bill was introduced by Democratic Senators Chuck Schumer of New York and Claire McCaskill of Missouri. They say it will add 10% to spending on border security over the 2010 level, along with an increase in Border Patrol agents and establishing 4 forward operating bases along the border. The measure puts aside $32 million for drone aircrafts to gather surveillance images and search for illegal activity. For a look at the increase in drones along the border, we're joined by Melissa Del Bosque. She's an investigative reporter with the Texas Observer magazine and writes the regular blog La Línea. Welcome to FSRN.
Thank you for having me.
U.S. Customs and Border Protection have been using drones along that border region since 2005. Now, this would mark an increase in their use. The ones that are being used today, what kind of drones are they and how are they being used?
The drones are using the Predator B. What they do is provide real-time video footage, and they can also do infrared And what they use them for is to look for smuggling routes along the border. And then what they do is they have an analyst that interprets the data that's sent from the drone, and then they contact Border Patrol to alert them if they see people coming across the border illegally.
One of the criticisms of the drone program abroad is that it's operated by people who are thousands of miles away, and so there's a kind of a breakdown in a chain of command, a breakdown in accountability. Is it clear at this point who would be controlling these drones and who would be controlling this information?
Well, Customs and Border Protection is training its own pilots. When they first started the program in 2005, they were using private contractors that work for General Atomics, which is the company that makes the drone. But they had a crash in 2006. A drone crashed into the side of a hill outside of Nogales, Arizona. And in hearing the testimony of Customs and Border Protection, they faulted the private contractor, and they say one of the things they're doing to improve their safety record is by training their own pilots to remotely operate the drones.
There have been other major and also costly security projects along the border since the 1990s. There was Operation Gatekeeper, Operation Hold the Line. There was that virtual fence that had major problems, and that was also led by Boeing. Boeing also makes a type of unmanned drone. Who stands to profit from this kind of program? Who are making these drones?
All the large defense contractors are making these drones. General Atomics makes the Predator B, which U.S. Customs and Border Protection is using. And as you said, Boeing Corporation had been the contractor for SBINet, which was an $8 billion project. And it was scrapped, I think, after they spent about $1 billion on it and figured out that it wasn't working. Basically, the usual large contractor companies that get a lot of Department of Defense contracts.
Now, a frequent complaint from border residents is that these Washington policies don't take into consideration the realities of border communities. As a border reporter there, what have you seen as an effective course of action, an appropriate course of action for policymakers?
I'm hearing from people that they just don't really understand the program. They're concerned about the safety data. They don't know what kind of information they're going to be providing to the government. Are they going to be invading people's privacy? There's a lot of questions that people have that really haven't been discussed by the federal government with the local communities.
So a lot of questions still to be answered. $32 million set aside in this Senate bill yesterday for more drones along the border region. Melissa Del Bosque is an investigative reporter with the Texas Observer. She writes a regular blog, La Linea, and she spoke to us about the push for more drones along the U.S.-Mexico border. Thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
California schools are facing massive budget cuts from the state. The weak economy is forcing some school districts to look at creative ways to bring in revenue and keep classes going. In Northern California's Mendocino County, one school district has turned to farming to raise funds and feed the community. From Ukiah, Christina Anastad has more.
It's 8:30 in the morning, and the Ukiah High School's ag department is bustling with students.
Who's in compost and soil building?
You guys turn around, please.
Nobody.
Giovanni's one of them.
These students are getting ready for a lesson in agriculture. They'll spend half their time in the classroom and the other half outdoors, working the school's 1.5-acre farm. Julie Drucker helps manage the program.
We're going through a full cycle of food production, so the kids are planting food, doing bed formation, learning how to make compost.
After harvest, the students will open their own farm stand on campus, and through a kind of co-op arrangement called community-supported agriculture, they'll sell the produce to teachers, families, and the greater community. The project is called the Hillside Farm, and it's funded with federal stimulus money. For 16-year-old DNA Garcia, the class has changed the way she views food.
I didn't really care what was in it or anything. As long as it was food, I just ate it. It's like now that I have a connection with agriculture, it's like, wow, we grew this and we're eating it and it's really good.
Students aren't just growing vegetables, they're also learning how to produce fish with a new sustainable fish farm on campus. A few yards away, a group of community volunteers is preparing the ground to lay concrete for the fish enclosure necessary for seafood like prawns and tilapia.
The fish are farmed at the bottom and the vegetables are farmed at the top.
Max Myers is an aquaponics expert spearheading the project.
The fish water is pumped out to the vegetables. The vegetables feed off the nutrient source in the water, thereby cleaning the water, and then the clean water returns to the fish, keeping them healthy.
Meyer says the project will be completely sustainable, using solar panels and methane from the fish waste. Restaurants, teachers, and community members can then buy the fish, and the proceeds will be used to keep the project running.
The other idea was is that it creates a student-run business. So it's an opportunity for the students here at Ukiah High School to have local employment, working for, you know, going back to our traditional skills of farming, but with a more modern twist.
Many students see the program as good for them and the larger community. Bobby Laux is a 17-year-old junior at Ukiah High and a member of Future Farmers of America.
The community's getting food out of it. The ag program's getting funding, and I think it teaches the students not only about agriculture, but about marketing, and that there is always a market for food, and always you're going to have the community wanting food.
In rural Northern California, jobs are scarce in the dwindling resource industries. Coupled with a poor economy, opportunities for youth are limited here. But organizers of the agriculture programs at the Ukiah School see a brighter future. Eric Crawford heads the ag department at the high school.
Especially with the recent push for local and organic food, because it's healthier and environmentally it's more friendly and more sustainable. That I think it's important for students to learn those practices.
Crawford says any profits will go to fund other school projects. But for now, the Hillside Farm is focused on bringing in about $20,000 to keep the project going. Christina Onnested, FSRN, Ukiah, California.
And that wraps up today's program. This is Free Speech Radio News. Thanks for listening. Until next week in New York, I'm Dorian Marina.